talk about nutrition and mental health. So this is an important topic because it's something that everybody should be thinking about, because food affects everything in your life, right? We all need food. It's an essential, it's a necessity of life, but the way you eat is going to have direct impact on your mental health. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. And so we're going to start off like we often do, and that is with
our disclaimer.
Yes, thank you.
I think it's important that listeners understand the purpose of our episode tonight is not necessarily to say use this diet or this diet. I think it's really about giving information. Mm-hmm. And I've become really interested in this because the research is really very strong that what we eat influences our body, our brain, our emotions, our mental health. So we are going to mention several different ways of eating, several different diets. But again, our intent is not to suggest a certain diet or a certain way of eating, but give you, the listeners, some information so that if you're interested, you'll have a place to start. And there's a lot of information out there. And I think this is a topic that a lot of people don't think about.
Yeah. Yeah.
As far as how it relates to mental health.
Yes.
I don't people think about that part.
I think you're right. And other than people know the effects that caffeine has on your system. And then people know the effects of sugar, right? Like they understand that. But I don't know that they think about it in terms of, oh, it gives me more energy and it's not good for me. They don't think about how it's going to affect your brain as much.
Right. Because I think there are a lot of people who know that sugar, I mean, hopefully they know that sugar isn't that good for us. Mm-hmm. But I don't think they realize exactly what's going on and what it can do on a physiological level. And I think sometimes information is helpful for people to make choices, you know, or at least to think about things in a different way. So we're going to start off. I listened to a podcast. I've mentioned Andrew Huberman before, and I think we'll put this in the show notes, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And so the one that we're going to start with, I think it's called Nutrition and Mental Health. But he interviews and he's talking with a psychiatrist by the name of Chris Palmer, who wrote a book called Brain Energy. And so I'm just going to go over the four different, I guess we could call it ways of eating or diets that we're going to talk about initially. And so one, this isn't going to be surprising probably to a lot of listeners because this is well known, the keto diet. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people know that, but usually it's probably in terms of weight loss. And so there are a lot of people do use it for weight loss. But I do want to say that when we're talking about these diets, the focus isn't on losing weight. That's not it. I mean, some of these diets may help you to lose weight, but that's not our focus tonight. So keto diet, what we call modified keto diet. And then just the third one is just a plain old reduction in the carbohydrates. And I think when we say carbohydrates tonight, hopefully people will understand we're talking about simple carbohydrates as opposed to complex carbohydrates. And then the fourth way is some type of fasting. And there are really a lot of different ways to do this that we'll talk about. So I thought it might be good to just define briefly what the keto diet is. A lot of people don't realize that there's a history to the keto diet and it goes back a long ways. Mm-hmm. And that when this was first developed was back in the 1920s. And there was a doctor who was treating, I think he was treating children mostly with epilepsy. And what he found is that if the children didn't eat, so that if they entered into a fasting state, then for many of them, the seizures either stopped completely or the seizures were reduced in a lot of ways. But, you know, if you think of fasting as a treatment method, you can't fast, you've got to eat. Yeah. So it's not that practical in the long run, especially for kids. I think that would be really hard to put them on a regimen of some sort of intermittent fasting. But what he figured out is what's going on in the fasting, it mimics the ketogenic diet. And so if you then reduce, so what a ketogenic diet is, essentially, is very low carb. Here's the part that's, I think this is the hardest part, because I've tried this, high fat. A lot of us, it's really hard to get the fat up to the percentage that you're supposed to have in order to put your body into ketosis, what is called ketosis. What that means is your body is producing more ketones. And so going back to this doctor who was treating the kids with epilepsy, he found that what fasting does is it also can put your body into ketosis. And that's the thing that helped with the epilepsy. So he started patients on the ketogenic diet, and it indeed either stopped the seizures or drastically reduced them. And they used that as a treatment method for a long time until then the drugs started coming out, you know, and the drug companies started getting the drugs. And so, I mean, if you consider taking a drug compared to being on a ketogenic diet, you know, you could debate which one's healthier. It's certainly easier to take a drug.
Yes.
And so the ketogenic diet as a way of controlling epilepsy fell out of favor, just in favor of the drug. But I think as Chris Palmer talks about it, it's becoming more prevalent because those drugs have a lot of side effects.
Yeah.
And so that's how the ketogenic diet started. But so again, low carb, high fat. And that I think is a really tough part. And as I said, I've tried this once. I had a really hard time getting the fat up. And I don't know if you've ever tried that or tried a keto diet or anyone who's been on a keto diet, but I think it's tough to do and maintain.
Yes, it is. So Curtis, when in 2020, he was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. And so his doctor said, you know, basically carbs are your enemy. So, you know, avoid carbs, but you can have all of the meat and cheese you want. And so that's when he started looking into keto diet. And so one thing that I don't think people understand, because Curtis didn't, and this is a big pitfall for him, he never thought about getting diabetes because he's like, I don't have a sweet tooth. I don't eat a lot of sugar. Well, it turns out he was, because carbs turn to sugar in your bloodstream.
Right.
So simple carbs. So potato chip, that's where he got himself into trouble. And he knows that like a lot of potato chips aren't good for you. And so, but he was doing a lot of other things. Like he was eating a lot of white bread or rolls or something. You know,
so those are simple carbs.
Yes.
Which go into sugar more easily.
Exactly. And so, you know, so he tried the keto diet, and the hardest part about it was that we had to prepare two meals every night. Because it's not a family friendly diet, especially if you have picky kids, which we do. Yeah. And so that was the hardest part. And it worked really well. I mean, he was able to get, because his A1C had skyrocketed. And yes, he did lose the weight and that felt good. But the most important benefit was that he got his A1Cs back in control, right? And so anyone who is familiar with type 2 diabetes, your A1C levels, I think a normal range is between like 5 and 6, around that, or maybe it's below 5. I don't remember. Don't quote me on that. I'm not a doctor. So I want to make that disclaimer now. I could be way off. That's, you know, if you are talking about this, you need to be talking about it with a doctor. So anyways, and so he was able to get his A1Cs back under control, and that was great, but it just wasn't sustainable because we were making two meals for everybody every night. And so eventually he went off of it. And, you know, now we're just trying to focus kind of on the psychology behind eating. And I think that's another thing that people don't think about, is it's not just about what you eat. It's about why you're eating.
Yeah.
I mean, because, you know, we all have to eat, right? But why are you eating right now? Are you eating because it's time for a meal and because you're hungry? Or are you eating because of an emotion that you're feeling?
Right. And then the other thing I think we talked about in a previous episode is those carbs tend to increase serotonin.
Yes.
And so it gives you that you're feeling better.
Mm-hmm.
So before we go back and talk about what the benefits are mental health wise from a keto diet, just the other types of diets that this Chris Palmer talks about in his book, he calls it a modified keto diet. And it's, this part was hard for me to understand what he's even talking about in comparison, say, to just a reduction in carbohydrates. And so in his modified keto diet, you aren't following the rules. And I can't remember what the exact percentages are, but there are these in a keto diet, there are certain percentages of fat, of calories that come from fat, certain percentage of calories that come from other protein, and then carbs. And I think you keep your carbs very low, like 13%, or, you know, even lower than that. And so to put yourself into ketosis, you also have to do some sort of test. The more accurate test is a blood test, but you can also use urine strips to test your urine. Not quite as accurate, but it can give you an idea if your body is producing ketones. And ketones can be used, and they are used in the brain as a source of energy, because usually it's glucose that our body needs glucose for our brains to work properly, but it can also use those ketones. So the modified keto diet, I think, is one that this psychiatrist suggests if people are having trouble holding firmly to those percentages. But it's important to understand that if your carb intake rises above 20% of your calories, then you're not going to be able to get into ketosis at all. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you compare that to his other, the third thing, just a reduction in carbohydrates, and what he found with his patients is that some people benefit greatly just from a reduction in the carbs and the sugar. Yeah. So he's talking about depression. So I'll jump into this, that he thinks that from his experience, the ketogenic diet has tremendous antidepressant qualities. Mm-hmm. And so if someone is dealing with depression and the medication isn't working quite so well, what they found is either that reduction in carbohydrates or even with the ketogenic diet in combination with the medication really makes the medication more effective.
Okay.
And so if I were considering trying this, I'd go maybe a stepwise program, which means just figure out a way to cut your carbs out and not worry so much about how do you increase the fat to the right percentage, and how do you, all those other percentages that you have to follow to get into ketosis, because you might get a lot of benefit.
Yeah.
And then the fourth way we're talking about is fasting. As I mentioned before, fasting also can put your body into ketosis. And fasting, I think we mentioned this in our episode on longevity, at least I hope we did, because it's a big part of longevity. And so, you know, what's interesting to me, I mean, this is a bit of an aside, but many of the world's religious traditions have a component of some sort of fasting. Mm-hmm. And so we're coming up to the month of Ramadan, which for the Muslims is a whole month of fasting during the day, and then they eat at sundown, and then they fast during the day. And I believe that's the way it goes. And certainly, like, the LDS culture has a once a month fasting. Mm-hmm. I think the Jewish tradition does. So I think there are many traditions that do this. And so there are a lot of health benefits that are coming out now about some sort of regular fasting. So you could do, as my daughter pointed out to me, that any type of fasting really can be considered intermittent fasting. It's just, depending on, like, once a week is intermittent fasting, or once a month is intermittent fasting. I think the way a lot of people think about intermittent fasting is they have a window in which, daily window in which they'll eat food. For instance, the window might be 6 hours. And so the rest of that time, the other 18 hours of the day, they aren't eating. And that window varies. I mean, it could be 8 hours, and it's different for every person. But it's what they found, and this goes back to our episode on longevity, but they found that when you put your body into that slight stress phase with when you aren't eating, that's actually healthy for you. But from a mental health standpoint, if you start making more ketones, then from the psychiatrist's experience, that is really healthy. And so here's what happened with him. His story is kind of interesting. So he was treating a man who was overweight, but he also had schizoaffective disorder. So most people are familiar with schizophrenia, and that's a pretty serious disorder. Well, schizoaffective disorder really is schizophrenia plus, because you include some mood disorders. And so it's pretty serious.
Yeah.
And so this patient of his had schizoaffective disorder. He was overweight, and he came to the doctor, and he realized that he wanted to be in a relationship, and he thought, I need to lose weight in order to be in a relationship. So the initial ask to the psychiatrist was, will you help me lose weight? And so, Dr. Pramal said, sure. He put him on a keto diet, and he started to lose the weight. 6 to 8 weeks in, with this guy being on the keto diet, his hallucinations, he had tremendous auditory hallucinations. His hallucinations and his paranoia all go away.
Wow.
And he also found it had a very powerful antidepressant effect. Plus, you get the weight loss. Mm-hmm. But what really interested the psychiatrist was what was going on with the schizoaffective disorder the decrease in the paranoia, the decrease in the hallucinations, the decrease in depression. And so we started using it with a lot of his other patients and found the same results.
Okay.
Now, you know, in the interview, it's interesting because I think everybody knows it's tough to stay on the keto diet unless you have tremendous willpower. And so the interviewer asked him, how did his patients do this? How'd they stay on it? And he thinks that it was the check-ins. And so they were doing weekly or every other week check-ins. Mm-hmm. And so it can be tough if you're doing it on your own. If you have someone who you can check in with, then I think it would probably be somewhat easier to stay on it.
Accountability.
Here's the important thing that I want the listeners to understand. If you're on medications, and this comes from the psychiatrist, do not stop your medications without the help of a doctor. And if you're going to try one of these different types of diets, then go ahead and start the diet. Do not stop your medication. And then if you want to, with a physician's help, you may want to then change your medication or start decreasing the medication. But never, ever stop your medication and then try the diet. That would not work. And it would be really difficult to do.
Yes. And I also want to note that intermittent fasting does not work for everybody health-wise. Mm-hmm.
That's true. That's true.
So, I mean, there are people out there who have medical conditions where fasting is not a good idea. So, right. I mean, it always warrants a conversation with your doctor, like, hey, I want to try this. What are your thoughts? So, you know, a really good example is my youngest son. He was recently diagnosed with ketotic hypoglycemia. And so he produces high ketones, which, and his blood sugar will plummet. So he cannot fast. It's not going to work for everybody, especially if you tend towards low blood sugar or if you tend towards that hypoglycemia. Do not fast.
Right. That's a good point, because what this does is it will lower your blood sugar.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think that's just something to be aware of. So let's get into food and emotions, because I think this is something that is really what people aren't thinking about. So we're going to get into, we'll talk about the vagus system and we'll kind of briefly go into that.
So, you know, as I was thinking about doing this episode, this is an obvious statement. This is an incredibly complex system.
Yes.
But if you think about the dopamine, so if we talk about sugar and our emotions, the dopamine is all about desire, the wanting, the motivation, mm-hmm. right, for something. And this is what I found really fascinating with sugar. So with the vagus nerve, a lot of people may know about that because it's in the health field, it's in mental health field. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about it. We aren't going to go into detail about it. But what the vagus nerve does, I think it's running down both sides of your neck and it goes down length and certainly down through your body. But what it's doing is it senses changes in your body. And it's like to our stomach and our immune system. It sends that information back up to the brain, but then it also activates some sort of movement. So for instance, on sugar. So this is what I wanted to say about sugar. A lot of people think, oh, I like the taste of sugar. So you put sugar in your mouth and it tastes sweet, right? Mm-hmm. But there are actually neurons in your stomach that sense the presence of sugar. And they've done experiments with this and research where they can put sugar in something to mask the taste. So you aren't tasting it, but your body reacts in the same way because as it enters your stomach, then, you know, these neurons in your stomach pick up that there's sugar there.
Yep.
And so what that does is it starts that dopamine system going.
Yep.
And what you want is then more sugar. So, this, I think a lot of, maybe people are aware of it or not, but if you pick up a lot of common products like salad dressing, mm-hmm. so if you pick that up, you're going to see sugar and it's probably up pretty high as far as how much sugar is in these products. If you're using salad dressing, you don't really have the sensation of anything sweet, right? Mm-hmm. Because there are all these other tastes that you're really after, but your body knows that you've ingested sugar. And so I think that manufacturers of a lot of products know this, maybe they all know it, and they put sugar in products when you don't have to have sugar in products, because what it's doing is it's causing you to want more of that product, mm-hmm. because it's activating those systems. And I think a lot of people don't realize that the message is that we're ingesting a lot of sugar, our body knows it, and we're wanting more of it.
Yeah.
It's really hard to eat those processed foods.
It's hard on your body. And yeah. I mean, you know, you get this high, so your serotonin levels are up, and then all of a sudden you have those energy and you feel great, and then you crash. And, you know, you want to take a nap is often what happens, is fatigue. I think people, oftentimes people suffer with fatigue, and they probably don't realize that a lot of it has to do with their diet. So, yeah. You know, they'll eat this high carb meal, and then 30 minutes later, they want to take a nap. They're tired. Their body is crashing. Their blood, mm-hmm. your blood sugar is, because your blood sugar skyrockets and then it drops. Okay, let's take a quick break and we will be right back.
Hi there, my name is Maya Acosta, and I'm the host of the Healthy Lifestyle Solutions podcast, where I explore ways that we can optimize our health. I learned about the field of lifestyle medicine, which uses evidence-based approaches to prevent, halt, and in even some cases, reverse disease. These are lifestyle modalities, such as using certain foods as medicine, using exercise to reverse disease, managing our stress, and even getting adequate sleep. Join me and the amazing people that I get to talk to as I set out to learn how taking better care of ourselves can help us both improve the quality of life and enhance our longevity. Let's get started.
Right. So I'll share something personal. I don't know that I share this with anyone, but and I'm better now. But with chocolate chip cookies, for whatever reason, I mean, if you think, I love the chocolate chip cookies. Mm-hmm. And I would always say this, and I would know this about this myself. I can't have one. If I have one, I'm going to have a dozen.
Yep.
It's mm-hmm. just, and I wish if I could have one, that would be great. But I can't. It's like it starts this cascade.
Yeah.
And it's so hard to stop. And, you know, maybe I just don't have the willpower that I need, but it just, this really makes sense to me, what we're talking about, mm-hmm. because the dopamine, the serotonin, everything starts flowing in your brain. You just want more of it till you feel sick. I mean, I've done that, you know, chocolate chip cookies. It's like, okay, I can't eat one more. It's really terrible. Here's another thing about some of the food. So if we move away from sugar, that again, going to what's in our stomach, and you know, it knows our stomach and all the nerve endings in there knows what we're eating. So the research indicates that we don't necessarily eat until we're full. Mm-hmm. We eat until our gut senses that we've ingested enough amino acids. So amino acids are really important. They're essential for so much in our body, essential for physical function. Building muscle, they're really important. They're essential for the production of those neurotransmitters in our brain, like dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine. So this is just an example. So there's an amino acid called L-tyrosine, and it supports the healthy production of dopamine. And so the foods that are rich in L-tyrosine will generally elevate our mood. Mm-hmm. Our foods like soy products, chicken, turkey, fish, peanuts, almonds, avocados, bananas, milk, cheese, yogurt, these all are all high in L-tyrosine. But what happens is sugar can disrupt the production of dopamine. And so it's important to really make, I think we just need to think more about the processed foods we're eating. I think in our episode on longevity, we did talk about processed foods, maybe not. But when we go back to gut health, processed foods are really terrible for our gut microbiome.
Yeah.
And that might be a word that some of our listeners are familiar with, because it's also something that's kind of up and coming as far as health goes, you know, paying more attention to your gut microbiome. And so the foods we eat can change our moods based on the production of the dopamine and the serotonin, or mm-hmm. the suppression of the production of the dopamine and the serotonin. And
correct.
So that's why I think that, you know, let's say you suffer with depression that is really tough to treat and you haven't found anything that really helps. I think look at your diet. Mm-hmm. Look at your diet and see what's going on. And maybe there are some changes that you can make there that will have some positive effect.
Yes. And so one thing that, going back to the keto diet a little bit, is one thing about ketosis, and when it comes to carbs, it's all about net carbs. And so fiber, if you can add more fiber to your diet, that's something that everybody can do that is really helpful. So, I mean, for example, net carbs let's say tortilla shells are something that we're familiar with because Curtis loves tacos and burritos. Mm-hmm. Like he loves his tortilla shells. There's like 30 grams of carbohydrate in one burrito sized tortilla shell. Okay. So what they do to get those net carbs is they will add 24 grams of fiber or 26 grams of fiber. All of a sudden you've got 4 grams of net carbs. And mm-hmm. And just so people are aware, in order to get into ketosis, you have to keep your carbs down to 30 grams or less a day.
Okay. That's a good figure to have out there, which is hard. It is for a lot of us.
Oh, very hard. I mean, Mark, you mentioned the chocolate chip cookies. I'm pretty sure one chocolate chip cookie has like 26 grams of carbs.
I'm sure it does. And so if you times that by 12, it's a dozen. Oh my God.
Yes. So, I mean, that's a great thing that people can start doing is just start reading your food labels and looking at the number of carbohydrates that foods have. Be more conscious and be more aware of what you're eating. And, you know, also the psychology of why you're eating. So I got into this really bad cycle a few years ago and I caught myself in it again recently. So the birth of our son, our youngest son, was traumatic for me. And then on top of that, he ended up in the NICU. So because he had some breathing problems. And there was at one point I'm sitting there and I'm nursing him and he kind of started to choke a little bit, which babies do a lot. They're not good at breathing. They're not good at eating. He started to choke a little bit. So I was kind of rubbing his back trying to, you know, get him going again, because this isn't my first kid and this happened. Well, he didn't start to bounce back and he started to get ashen colored. And so the nurse immediately grabs him from me and right there in front of me, she calls a code and there's doctors and there's nurses running around. Like all of these nurses are flooding in here and they're running this code on my son and giving him CPR because his heart rate had dropped and they're suctioning. And it was traumatic for me. Yeah. I mean, that's a horrible thing to go through. And so what I started doing after that, rather than dealing with the emotional pain of that and the psychological pain, I started using food, in particular sugar, as a coping mechanism. Mm-hmm. And so I got into this really awful, vicious cycle of obviously you have postpartum hormones and all of these other things that are going on. And then I found myself doing the same thing again recently when my son ended up in the hospital. We talked about that last week. Yeah. During family crisis. And so, you know, I was able to catch myself and realize what I'm doing. Okay. I'm using sugar to cope with this trauma, to cope with these psychological pains that I'm having. And I think that's something to be aware of, because if you think about it, I think you'd be surprised at how often that happens to people, people use sugar and food as a coping mechanism subconsciously.
I think it happens a lot. A lot. I just want to cover the gut microbiome before we run out of time.
Yes.
And three important things. So a lot of people may be familiar with that, but when we use the term gut, we're not just talking about the stomach, but we're talking about the intestines as well. And actually the whole system goes from your mouth all the way to the end, and so in there are a lot of microbes that are helping us to digest the food. And so what they call that, the gut microbiota, and there's a lot of research that's been done on this right now. And so that microbiota communicates with the central nervous system through neural, endocrine, and immune routes, and it helps to control brain function. And so what a lot of people don't understand is what's going on in your gut has a lot to do with the regulation of anxiety, mood, how we're thinking, a lot of people call it brain fog. If you get brain fog and pain. And so the two things to remember, and this is, I'm just going to throw this out so that listeners, if they want to learn more, you can, you know, go do some research on it yourself. Fermented foods end up being really good for the gut microbiome.
Okay.
So now one that I can't even pick up a bottle of kombucha because it just doesn't look good to me. But that is a fermented drink that is fairly popular now. If you use that, though, you have to be careful, because what producers have done is they've got this kombucha, but they put a lot of sugar in it. So, it's not really helpful. But for instance, yogurt is a fermented food. There are also, what's it? Tomorrow is St. Patrick's Day. But what is the food that goes along with corned beef? Cabbage, but it's...
Corned beef and cabbage.
Yeah, and it's fermented though in some way.
Oh, okay, okay.
But if you're looking for fermented foods, like if you want pickles, these are not the pickles that are on the store shelves. They're the pickles that are in the refrigerated section.
Okay.
Because for it to be effective, it has to be refrigerated. Otherwise, there's nothing live in it. And what you're wanting in the fermented food is the live bacteria, essentially, okay, that you're putting into your gut.
So I want to clarify something here, because a lot of people think or hear fermented and they think alcohol. What's the difference? Because alcohol is often fermented fruit, right? And so What's the difference here for people who are thinking, well, I'm not going to do anything fermented because I abstain from alcohol?
Well, they actually talk about this in one of the podcasts that we'll reference about the gut microbiome. And they ask about beer specifically.
Okay,
beer is fermented. But what is true about alcohol, tremendously high amount of sugar.
Okay.
Right, that goes along with it. And these other fermented foods don't have the sugar in them.
Okay.
And so some of these fermented foods can be costly, but there are places out there on the internet where you can make your own.
Okay. And it's not, so fermented food, because I think the important takeaway is it's not going to be intoxicating.
It's not alcoholic. No.
Yes.
There's no alcohol in it at all.
Yeah.
And so, because the alcohol is, I mean, in my mind, is synonymous with a lot of sugar.
Okay. Yeah.
So fermented foods are really good for the microbiome, but what is not good are highly processed foods and foods high in sugar.
Yes.
And so, you know, all of this kind of ties together, if you think about it, that, I mean, we had these three different areas, you know, as far as the different types of diets and then food and emotions and then the gut microbiome, but they're really coming back to the same thing, which is don't eat so many highly processed foods.
Yep.
Decrease your carbs and your sugar. And then eat some, you know, yogurt's good for you. A lot of people can take yogurt, but you have to really be careful because a lot of yogurt has sugar in it as well.
Yep.
But you can buy there's a lot of yogurt out there that's just, it'll say plain yogurt.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get used to the taste because it's going to taste sour. So fermented foods are going to taste sour.
Okay.
But I think that as a culture, our taste palates have become used to sweet things.
Mm-hmm.
But you can easily just shift that back.
Right. Okay.
And so that you aren't so used to it and it actually tastes good to you. In fact, this Chris Palmer talks, maybe it's someone else, talks about getting their kids to like plain yogurt. And the way they did it is they added a little bit of honey and then they decreased the honey. And over time, I mean, over a long period of time, the kids don't know the difference and they're used to the non-sweetened yogurt.
Greek yogurt.
So we can get used to it. Mm-hmm. It just takes some effort and work.
Yeah.
So I think the takeaway for our listeners, it's pretty simple. What we eat and what we take into our body has a profound effect on our mental health and our moods. And if you are struggling, say with depression, I think it's really important to try something else. And you haven't been, and it hasn't been successful because a very high percentage of people do not respond to antidepressants.
Right. So the best thing that you can do is, if you're curious, is start a food journal. Right.
Yeah.
Start a food log.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you want to know how what you're eating is affecting your mood, write down what you're eating and then record your mood, I don't know, 30 minutes later or so. Right. So just track that.
I really like that. But if you're keeping a food journal, I'd add two columns. And just write down the total number of carbohydrates or the net carbs and then the amount of sugar.
Yeah.
Just so you can see what's going on, because I think we don't realize how much sugar we're taking in.
Yep.
And it'd probably be shocking to a lot of us to know.
Yeah. And I mean, another great thing that I think everybody should be doing is just drink more water.
That's true. Yeah.
I mean, you will be amazed at the results you can find of just simply increasing your water intake.
Well, be better hydrated.
Yeah. Well, and especially if you drink a bunch of water right before you eat, you're going to feel fuller. You're not going to eat as much.
That's true.
So, you know, I mean, little things that you can do, and sometimes little changes can make a huge difference. And so people might be listening to this and thinking and feel overwhelmed. They're like, oh man, I need to make all of these big changes. Take it a step at a time. Right.